You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, as you well know. This is another episode recorded live at the Gilded Balloon at last year's Edinburgh Fringe. We've got just four left after this one, and this one could have gone on and on and on very happily indeed. With a lot to say and an admirable candour, which is always my favourite combination, this is the phenomenally funny Ed Byrne.
Thanks, Ed. Put your legs back now.
Thank you, Ed. Thanks for coming. How are you?
I'm good. I'm very well. Excellent. Nice to be here. The question I get asked most often is, in all the times you've been coming to the Fringe, what big changes have you seen?
Okay.
And for me, it's more people are doing podcasts.
Yes.
That's the thing.
Absolutely.
I had no idea when this thing was invented that allowed me to carry my record collection around in my pocket that it also meant every day I'd be talking to another comedian for their podcast. But thanks for coming.
Yeah. Hopefully, this will be a slightly different conversation to ones that you've had before. If you'd like to buzz in at any moment, if you feel we're treading path that's too well worn, I'd be happy with that because I'm keen not to go down the route of any other podcasts that you've done before.
You know what, dude? This is the closest I'll ever get to being on Inside the Actor's Studio, so I'm just
good. Okay, well, let's go with that. Fine. Happy days. So if you'll permit me just some generic kind of warm-up questions for the first 5 minutes, tell us about your show. How is your show this year progressing? Are you happy with it?
Yes, and I'll admit, and I hope there'll be people listening now who'll probably demand their money back then, because I wasn't entirely happy with the first three.
Okay.
Having done all previews, and by and large had them go well, and I was ending on a joke that I thought worked. When you're writing a new show, it's like your opening joke and your closing joke is your most important one. And I thought, I was really happy with my closing joke. I went, now I just have to write all the bits in between.
Okay.
And grand. And then I brought it up here, delighted with it. And I would get to the end every night and it would go, oh, this closing joke's not a closing joke, is it?
Oh, shit.
And that was, that was a bit worrying. But now I have a closer.
Okay.
Awesome closer.
Is it that you've fixed the existing closer or you've gone?
I've moved the closer to the middle now.
Okay.
It's been relegated.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is a really. It's like when they move something from prime time into daytime.
Yeah, okay.
It's not a good sign for a joke. I sat it down and I broke it to it and said, it's not working out.
Can you tell us?
We decided to go another way.
Let's get specific about it. What was the joke? Would you mind telling us what the joke is?
I have a thing in the show about. I have rules as to who can be my friend and who can't now.
Sure,
because I have too many friends because I have children now and I don't have time to see the friends I've got. Plus I have new friends who got to be my friend just because they have children the same age as mine, which I think is a sneaky way into my life. That's sort of, my wife likes your wife. Well, I guess I'm going on holiday with your dull fucking arse for the rest of your life. So I have this thing about, and I have different triggers about, while I go, I can't be friends with you. Like if you use this phrase or you do that, you do this. And so one of them is, if you have ever said, oh, I've touched a nerve there. I think people who say that, I hate people who say I've touched a nerve there because somebody says that to you when they've insulted you and you've had the temerity to get offended by their insult. And then they take that to mean their insult is true. And it's just a horrible conversational gambit to just pull on somebody. You're a terrible father. What do you mean I'm a terrible father? Touch a nerve there. And it's just, I will touch your nerves and not in a nice way. And So I say to the audience, say, if anybody of you have ever said this, take this home with you and write it on your mirror and never forget it. You are a worthless, slimy maggot, a worthless piece of shit. And your only way to make yourself feel better about yourself is to make other people feel worse about themselves. And if that hurts to hear, I've touched a nerve there.
Sure.
Which I think it's nice. It's sort of circular. It's going to size it all up. And all this. And it had been working really, really well. And I don't know whether I'm putting too much into it and people could see the end coming or what, but it just wasn't flying.
Okay.
And what I had been closing with, or what I had been, like, before that, I've been telling a story about a vasectomy, a potential vasectomy.
Yeah.
That's very funny and has a lot of lines in it and towards the end there's some very funny, you know, jokes in it. Mm-hmm. But it's a weird thing is that even though there's big laughs in it, I could close on the biggest laugh, but it's like you'd almost leave the audience going, yeah, but and then what happened in the story?
Okay,
it's like the actual
okay.
end of the story isn't particularly funny.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
And just kind of, you can't just go big laugh and then go, oh, and so then we decided not to do it after all. Good night, you know.
Yeah, okay.
So that's why it needed to just, even though it was big laughs, I still thought, oh, right, it's a funny joke, but it's not a closing joke.
Sure.
It's, you know, that's a funny sure. thing about it. When you're doing an hour-long show, it needs to have just that sort of level of structure where your closer's got to be a bit big.
Sure. At what point do you think you learnt that in particular? In terms of like lessons you've learnt as a comedian, I mean, everyone always says you close on your funniest bit. So that's quite a sort
open
of sophisticated...
with your second funniest joke, close yeah. on your funniest joke.
Yeah. yeah. And like, yeah, you're looking at it from the perspective of, okay, that might be the funniest joke, but that still doesn't mean it's right for the end.
Yeah.
When did you kind of catch on to that? That's obviously, you've been a comedian for a very long time. That's quite a sophisticated, you know, that's like another level of.
Yeah, I don't know. And it's one of those things that you don't consciously think about. I don't think. That much. I think it's something you maybe learn instinctively at first, and then make more conscious decisions on as you sure. go on, as you get better at working out what is, as I say, what constitutes a closing joke and what doesn't. Generally, like a lot of comedians, I'll see, particularly if they're doing a big long themed show, they'll finish on something quite emotional, like it's a best man speech.
Yes,
you know,
okay.
And they'll finish on, you know, call your dad because yeah, you might yeah. never see him again or something like
sure.
that, where it's all very
some kind
tear-jerky.
Of emotive message
yeah.
at the end of it. Yeah.
And I've never gone that far.
Okay.
Because I'm not deep enough.
Okay.
I don't do sincerity very well, honestly. I something that's got a nice build to it rather than just a funny one-liner, I always think is a nice way to
okay.
to get off.
And where in the lifetime of this show are we now? You were doing previews, this is the show opening before it goes on tour?
Yeah.
Or is it... Okay.
Because exactly
I wondered, when I saw you more than a week ago now, I wondered, you had a table with you, I wondered if you had notes on it for the show. Were you still at a stage where you were looking at the running order?
I did have a sheet. I had a cheat sheet for the first three nights I needed it. And then
okay.
I just kept showing up, and because there was nothing else in the room before me or anything like that, so it just got left on that table.
Okay.
And I didn't need it anymore, and I kept going, I must remember to remove that.
Sure.
Because I always think as well that people are coming along going, he's got notes.
Yeah.
This isn't all off the top of his head at all. Because even though people know that you've written a show and stuff like that, you still create an atmosphere and an image. And I think we all kind of go along with it together as if you're just talking off the top of your head, even though we all know that's not the case. And I think notes, you know...
It kind of breaks that illusion a little bit, doesn't it?
You know.
Okay.
So I did get rid of it. And they were a bit of a Dumbo's feather as well, and that I didn't really need them anymore. I just liked to have them sitting there.
Sure. Okay. I think that's often the case. I see a lot of comics on the circuit who still write things on their hand before they go on.
Yeah, and some of them just do it because they want to be Stuart Lee. Some
yeah, right. Okay.
Yeah. Some people just do it because they just want to look more comic-y.
Oh, I've been having thoughts and yeah. making notes.
People just want to, oh, look, I've just got scrawls all over my hand like I'm that bloke in Memento. And it's Guy Pearce. Yeah, isn't it? Ironic that I forgot his name. But, and I think people do that sometimes just to make it look like they're more of a... They're working harder.
Okay.
I've been scribbling this shit down all
yeah.
day.
Certainly, something I'm very guilty of, and a lot of other acts I've known do the same thing, is I've got a notebook and I'll write down my set list before I go on. I'll write down the set list. And then I look at the book later and it's just the same set list written over and over again countless times.
I've seen people do it, and particularly sort of American alternative comics of walking on with a piece of paper.
Mm.
Like at big gigs, and it's part of their image that they're reading off notes that it
makes it look fresher. Maybe do you think
that's the ironic thing? Is that it's supposed to make it look more like I've just thought of this today, and they're doing the same set that they've been doing. Like
yeah,
I was at the Aspen
right.
Comedy Festival back in the day, and I remember Sarah Silverman, doing the exact same set, word for word, using this piece of paper as if she'd just written it.
To just kind of hipster it up somehow.
Yeah. And also, I think it helped. It helped, like, there was one joke where she's almost blaming the piece of paper for the fact that it's there, you know?
Yeah, okay.
So, it's an interesting prop that some people use.
Okay.
The note.
So with this, coming back to your show,
let's talk about me again. What am I doing talking about other comedians?
how many previews did you do, or when in the year did you start writing the show that you're currently doing at the EICC?
I suppose I started writing it properly in March.
Okay.
Really doing that thing of looking around at things and you know, doing that thing where you're basically making yourself go slightly mad. That's okay. What it's like, I think. It's like you suddenly start deliberately trying to misunderstand everything about everyday life. You're looking at everything in such a lateral way of going, why is that this shape? Why is my wife looking at me? Because she's your wife, she's supposed. It's just everything. You just question every aspect of existence in a way that's somewhere between schizophrenia and autism.
Okay, and that's a mode. You think that's a mode that you can consciously switch on?
Yeah, you kind of switch your brain into it almost, yeah. Okay. Where you're just questioning and just viewing everything in this skewed way to try and find comedy in it.
Is that how you've always worked when you started doing comedy? That's where you kind of trained up that mindset?
Some of it. And some of it is just, to be honest with you, most of my stuff, my favourite stuff is stuff that it just comes from arguments I have had and the things I wish I'd said in those arguments. Mm-hmm. And just dwelling. I am one of those people, I can't get to sleep at night for thinking of the things I wish I'd said to some guy who was rude to me in a shop or whatever, you know.
That makes up a component of this show and other shows of yours that I've seen. And I was going to ask how much truth there is to that. Or is that just kind of, because that's quite a useful framing strategy for like an argument
about that
you've had.
Yeah, I talked about it last show or the show before that. I actually had a whole thing about that, about the fact that I obsess on the things I wish I'd said to people in arguments. But it is, it's completely true. Okay. I hold on to arguments I've had, and my wife will hear me doing it. I joked in the show about it that she can tell when I'm having an argument with somebody in my head. She'll just see my hands move in a certain way, and she'll just see the glazed look, and she'll go, "You've just thought of something you wish you'd said to somebody in an argument." And I go, "Yes, I have." And she go, "How long ago was this argument?" I'm like, "About 18 months ago now." And she go, "That's what I thought. Now get off me."
Is that? Do you think?
Yeah.
Do you think that's a family trait? Because I know your brother Paul rather better than we've spent any time together socially, and he is phenomenally argumentative. And is that's something that's definitely a trait of the two?
Back when he used to drink, and because I still do. Oh man, you should have seen some of the arguments we had. Fucking ludicrous! I swear to God, one Christmas we had a proper stand-up yelling in each other's faces over whether or not Star Trek: The Next Generation was better than Star Trek: The Original Series.
Okay,
and it was it was yelling. Like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Like, that kind of thing.
Okay.
Yeah. And the people around us, like, mainly his friends, are like, these guys don't even get on. And it was like, yeah, we're an argumentative bunch.
Okay. And were you like that when you were children?
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I still obsess on things I wish I'd said in that argument about Star Trek. You know, that was a good 15 years ago.
Which of you won that argument out of interest?
Neither of us.
It's ongoing.
Yeah. I think because none of us are going to walk away and go, well, I guess it's just a matter of taste. No, I have to empirically prove.
Why? Why do you need to prove it like that? Why is there their argumentative nature?
We're dicks. I don't know. I accept that.
let's look a little bit further into it. Why do you think that is? Was it some sort of challenge between the two of you growing up? I mean, was it each other that inspired that argumentative nature? Because it's kind of seeded throughout a lot of your stand-up. And I think a lot of the attitudes that you take with something as a starting point, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I imagine you argue against something. When you're in that mode of seeing the world, part of that thought is it maybe, why is that like that? Why should that be like that?
Well, I think we could go into further psychoanalysis on why I would argue a lot with my family. And I think a lot of us do. With my whole family are all very funny. And even though Paul now makes a living in the comedy industry as a director and producer and all that kind of thing, at the time he didn't, and no one else in my family did. And I think there was a huge seething resentment from my entire funny family that I was the only one who actually became a funny person after living.
And why do you think...
Seething resentment.
That's incredible. That's not. I sometimes talk on the podcast almost like superheroes of trying to find out each comedian's origin story.
Yeah.
Like, you know, were you struck by lightning or you fell in radioactive stuff? So you had a funny family.
The entire family's funny, but it was my eldest brother was the eldest, so my older sister was the only girl, and my younger brother was the baby, and I was just the other one.
So you were like
I'm now on the stage.
A super middle child.
Do you hear me, father? Do you hear me?
And you were you competing against your mum and dad to be funny as well?
Well, my mum is very funny, certainly. I mean, dad is funny in his own way, but in a very sort of, you know, old-fashioned way of just telling the same jokes every Christmas.
Okay.
Kids are like farts, you can barely stand your own. Hilarious, father. Hilarious.
So when you... did that motivate your first decision to go on a stand-up stage?
No, but I remember very early on, my older brother had a Billy Connolly album, The Pick of Billy Connolly, a vinyl album of stand-up comedy, which seems like a very weird thing to own nowadays. And listening to that and sitting in the kitchen and me looking at me dad sitting there laughing at it and like sitting around it as if we were in the 50s or something, you know. And it was really cool. And I was very, very young and impressionable. And I used to talk along with that album. I also used to play along to like Live After Death by Iron Maiden with a tennis racket.
Okay.
But I used to talk along to The Pick of Billy Connolly in exactly the same way as you would as a child play along to music. And so I think that got put in my head very, very early on.
Okay.
The desire that, or the idea that this could be a thing that people do.
So out of your family that were listening to it, you were the one who was speaking along with it and taking it away and listening to it.
No, I didn't do it when anybody else was around. I just did it on my own. Yes, that's right. Listening on my own to a comedy album, talking along with it. Looking back, it's quite pathetic, really.
Sure, okay. So then when you first took that onto the stage, you were at Strathclyde University, is that right?
Yeah.
And you started a comedy club there. Was that your first...
No, that was after I dropped out. When I was at college, I was involved in the entertainment. I was the social convener, as it was called, the Ents bloke. And then I was also the vice president, and I used to host the karaoke's and pub quizzes, and I have to make speeches and at student council and freshers' welcomes and stuff like that. And I would jazz it up with the odd gag.
Okay.
So I got a taste for... Well, the rest of them all went into politics or the trade union movement. I went into stand-up.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's kind of where I got the taste for it. And then I dropped out, and then I started a comedy club in Glasgow in a pub called The 13th Note on Glasford Street, and did that every Wednesday.
Okay.
And had both of the guys from Still Game. Any Scottish people? Still Game, are you familiar? Still Game? Ford Kiernan and Greg Hemphill both did stuff individually.
Okay.
And Phil Kay was on.
Oh, yeah.
Bruce Morton.
Okay. Were people like, I don't know the other two, were people like Phil Kay and Bruce Morton, were they already established?
They were already established at the time. Okay. Yeah. But Ford Kiernan, I mean, he was new. He was new at the time. You know?
Sure.
I mean, he was already rich, to be honest. He made a lot of money in phone lines. So I don't know what he was. A businessman. But he was getting established as a stand-up comic.
Okay.
But he was new. Yeah.
So when you started off, what would you say your voice was like as a stand-up comic? And is it like the voice that you have now? Or was there a big change?
The biggest change I've made over the last 20 years... Fuck, I'm old. Is I'm more anecdotal now. I tell stories more, whereas I used to just it was more observation, I guess you could say. Whereas I used to be more, have you ever noticed this? I'm now more. The funny thing happened to me on the way to the gig.
Sure.
And I also this is a little rule that I have for myself now is unless it's like just a ridiculous joke that's obviously just a joke, I don't say anything now that I don't actually think.
Okay.
See, I used to quite happily say anything that would, if that opinion then helped me make the joke, then that would be the opinion I would hold. So I would get up and I'd say, I hate kids. Even though I've never hated kids. I used to work as a babysitter.
Okay.
I've always loved kids, not in an Operation U-Tree type way, but I've always been very, I do.
Sure.
But I would get on stage and go, I fucking hate kids, and do a rant about them because it was funny.
How did that?
Now.
Okay.
And I don't know at what point that happened. That was sometime around in the last 10 years. I kind of set myself that test or that goal or whatever that I wouldn't say anything that I didn't actually think.
And you've been someone who's always had a kind of your career seems to me to always have had a trajectory. So presumably, longer ago.
Not always up though.
No, fair enough. Yeah, good point. Further ago than 10 years, you were being successful doing stuff like I Hate Kids. That you know that was successful stuff, even though you didn't believe in it. So what did that feel like to be? To be kind of like taking an idea and going, I'm interested in the process of that because I write stuff and I find if I don't believe it, I can't say it in the first place. And I think that holds me back because I don't know, I don't have super strong opinions about stuff that I want to argue. I'm not an argumentative sort of person.
Mm-hmm.
But if you
I
kind
think
of.
You were.
Was that?
I think you were. Let's see what happens. Let's see how you respond.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Oh, yeah. He's good, isn't he? He's good.
But so that thing of, yeah, I just want to talk a bit more about that idea of saying something you don't believe for the sake of mileage.
Even early on, I always just think it was weird when you'd have a guy going on stage who was married with kids and he's talking about how he's just broken up with his girlfriend. Sure. I always thought that was kind of, why would you? I always was true in that way, in that if I was single, I'd say I was single. If I was, you know, if I'd just been dumped or if I was whatever, that sort of stuff, I always would for some reason be honest about. But just my opinions on things, I would happily just for the sake of, it doesn't matter what I actually think. It's just, I'm just making a joke.
Okay.
And as I say, I just got, it became a thing of, when I was getting married, I had a whole thing about, I didn't want to have that thing of doing the ceremony and then the wife wants to have it this way and I want to have it this way. And have her painted as a stereotypical ogre, you know, wanting the marriage to be like this, and that was the classic conflict. The truth of it was, we both hated everyone in the wedding industry because of what a pain in the arse they are.
Sure.
And they want to have the part of the problem with the wedding industry is they think that you are really enjoying the process, because for the most part, most women are, particularly women. In fairness, they quite enjoy the thrill of trying on the dresses and having meetings about invites and stuff like that. It's all part of the couldn't give a shit, either of us. Mm-hmm. And so having those meetings were really irritating. And I was trying to make that funny, and it wasn't working.
Okay.
To the point where my wife, now Claire, said to me, look, I think you should change tack on this and just paint me as the ogre, and that would be funnier.
Okay.
And I said, no, I stuck with it. And I'm really glad I did, because it came out really funny.
Okay.
And in a way that men and women could relate to, you know.
Sure. So with taking that as an example, that starting point of weddings, that came from a point of view of you were passionate about something and some sort of aerial said, this could be funny. Is that right?
Yeah.
Is that?
And I think that's what's going to mark you out. I think it's, if you just go with that, what's easier to be funny, then you will just end up sounding like absolutely everybody else, mm-hmm. you know. I think that's what I love about Louis C.K. I'm sure he probably gets brought up quite a lot on this show, because he's a real sort of comics comic. And he will take a subject that's been done to death, that's mm-hmm. considered really hack, like being on airplanes or mm-hmm. having kids, all that stuff. But he is so obviously personal about it, and he's saying what he genuinely thinks about it, that he breathes new life into it. And that's what I try to do.
So this is Ed. Right from the off, I love acts who can talk frankly here about stuff not working as well as they'd liked without any need to sort of front it out for the sake of public transmission. So I'm loving this conversation, and I love hearing about the differences in the job once you're off the circuit and in that constant sort of writing, rehearsing, touring loop. We've got an intriguing analogy coming up regarding comics as musicians, singer-songwriters or boy bands. You know I love an analogy. Ed is on tour at the moment until the beginning of May. Details at edburn.com. So get on top of that. He's terrific live. I really recommend you go and see him. I just apologise for the state of my voice at the moment. I am off work sick. I've pulled a bunch of gigs this week in order to stay at home and recover from a horrible chest infection. So, I've got to recover really, because this Thursday marks the start of my very first weekend at the Comedy Store. So do come along if you're around. Come and smile at me and watch me and come and lay a cool hand on my forehead and basically make sure I'm all right. I'm not bloody missing that, so I'll go along even if I have to dose up on Red Bull. An awesome lineup of very funny friends as well there for my first weekend, which makes me feel both secure and also slightly terrified because they're all so good. Remember too, if you're listening in New Zealand, I'm going to be performing my new show in Auckland and Wellington during the comedy festival there in a month or so. In the brochure in New Zealand, it's called He-Wolf, although that's changed now for Edinburgh, where the show will be called Extra Life. Not as funny a title, I grant you, but much more appropriate now I've written most of the sodding thing. Thank you for your emails and tweets. Big love to John Smith. I'm assuming not the comedian of that name, a brilliant comedian, but simply a man who made a huge donation to the show that I'm reeling from a bit. And thanks to him for the following words. He talks about some very tough stuff he's going through at the moment. And he says, being a comedy nerd and enjoying comedy has gotten me through this. The Gary Delaney interview you've just done has made me laugh for the first time this week. You do this for free, and whilst I probably can't afford this much, without having a laugh, I wouldn't keep getting out of bed and earn a penny. So thanks for making me laugh out loud and all the efforts that goes into the podcast. I should point out I've had a chat with him since, predominantly to offer him his donation back, which he didn't accept. Thank you, John. And the particular idea that tickled him in the Gary Delaney podcast was the phrase hacky spunky tears. John, thank you so much for your donation. Thanks to all of you that have helped me make a significant dent in the costs from last year's Edinburgh run. You too can donate at comedianscomedian.com by clicking on the PayPal button and choosing the size of your donation. They don't all need to be massive, just most of them. Ha! Now, on the subject of Edinburgh, lots of people have been asking if I'm taking the show back up there for 2014. And the answer at the moment is that I'm thinking of doing some hit-and-run shows. I'm not going to go in the programme for ComCom or for the full run, but I do hope to get some interviews done, either recorded in people's accommodation, their digs, or the odd live one where I can fit into a gap in a free fringe venue or a paid venue and just leap in and make it happen last minute. That's the plan. You can help with it. If you're involved in running a venue, and if you spot you might have a little gap for me here or there, like a little Saturday afternoon gap or a late night Monday gap or whatever. You know what a gap is. If you've got one of them, we can make it happen on the fly. So just keep an eye out and just remember that I'm looking out for them. If you know anyone running venues, they mention they've got a gap, ask them to get in touch with me if they wouldn't mind, if you would be so kind. And finally, video highlights from this show and the last seven or eight Edinburgh ones are all available online at youtube.com/comcompod. So have a peep at those if you'd like to see what we look like in the flesh. And if you're telling friends about this podcast, then they might serve as a useful thing to stick onto people's Facebook walls. That's up to you. Go and graffiti the hell out of people. That is all the podmin for now. Yes, podmin, that's the phrase. That's all the podmin for now. Let's get back to Mr. Ed Byrne.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Do you see a subject and go, that hasn't been covered before? Or do you see a subject like weddings and wedding planning and think...
Sorry.
Or do you see a subject like wedding planning and think, everyone's going to get that, that's going to be accessible, so now the job for me is to find stuff that hasn't been found?
Whatever is going on in my life, that's what I then want to talk about. And that's about the size of it. And that, I'm one of those people, like, again, going back to when first writing this show, most people, if they got a speeding ticket that said that they could go on the driver awareness, you know, the speed awareness course, we'd think, what a pain in the arse. I've got to spend 4 hours being patronised. But I went, there's bound to be some material in this.
Yeah, sure.
And there was. It was a good 5 minutes at the opening of the show. I have a whole thing about that, my time on that. I had a hernia this year and had to go and have an operation for that. And I thought, but the whole time I'm thinking, there'll be something in this. And there is. That's all. It's all in the show. Everything that happens becomes, you know...
Okay.
It becomes a rich seam. So I it wasn't that I thought, oh, getting married is a thing people can relate to. It's like, it was a thing I was going through. That makes it sound like how... That's not very romantic at all, is it?
Presumably you had some other feelings about it as well.
I'm glad I didn't say that in my speech. Yeah. I have to say, going through this has been... It's been a trial, but it's been worth it. I talk about whatever's going on.
Okay.
And I think that it makes it easier as well. If somebody hands you a blank sheet of paper and says, draw me a picture, you'll spend the first half an hour trying to decide what to draw a picture of. Mm-hmm. Or if somebody says, draw me a picture of a castle, even if you're not very good at drawing castles, you've got more time to draw the thing now. Mm-hmm. So if you go, this is what's going on, so I'm going to write jokes about this.
Sure.
It gives you a...
Okay.
A lot of the best jokes I've written have been jokes where I've needed to get from one subject to another.
Okay, to transition from...
I've got a link there, so I'm trying to find a way to link this subject to that subject, and in doing that, being forced to write the joke, the classic mother of invention thing, that ends up being the best joke. And I have dropped the stuff on either side and just kept the joke that was originally supposed to link to, because that's been the better joke.
Sure.
When I force myself, I need something on this, then I do it.
Okay. Do you find, I think I've spoken to some of the comics who've done shows like Mock the Week, where you get given a list of, you know, targets beforehand, that they find that really focuses them, because they're like, okay, you've got to come up with something about this.
Yeah.
Do you find that? Is that a similar sort of...
You come up with something that I would never normally write it. And I've got, like, stuff in the show this year that's some stuff about politicians. That's mainly stuff that I originally thought of for Mock the Week and then wasn't... Because the thing with Mock the Week, you know what's going to come up because of what's in the news. You have to watch the news and this is what's going to come up, basically. And also, there's a lot of cheating. So... So you get told what's going to come up, but I'll write a joke, you know, and it'll go out. But then, like, the more I think about that joke, because I don't just dwell on the things I wish I'd said. I dwell on the things I've actually said as well.
Yeah, okay.
So is that like the joke gets better?
Sure.
So like I've got a routine in this show that I'm really very pleased with.
Is that the Shadow Cabinet?
Not the Shadow Cabinet. The thing about the work shy.
Okay.
That I did, you know, that's just getting better every night because I'm still just working on it every night. And it has gone out on an episode of Mock the Week, but it's just like two lines and it gets a bit of a murmur because it's funny, but it's not hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
But it's now like a 2-minute bit.
Okay.
That's a really rabble-rousing thing. And it would be annoying if people watched it and I heard that on Mock the Week. No, you didn't. You heard one line of that on Mock the Week.
Sure.
Because since then, it's just grown into a routine.
Okay. You know? Okay. And do you find, just talking about the TV stuff for a moment, do you have certain rules about, you know, once something has gone out, you know, once a finished bit has gone out on air or in a DVD or sort of on a TV show, is that it burnt or would you still tour it if it had been in a clip on a show?
It's a very difficult one, that. It's a very difficult one to know whether to drop something or not, because it depends, because you'll do a joke on a show and only some people will watch it and people... Like, I had a thing... in my show where I just referred back to it. I was talking about children in age-inappropriate clothing. And I had a whole routine about a kid I saw wearing a T-shirt with I love pussy like a fat girl love cake. That was what he did. It was a kid. It was like a 13-year-old boy with this written on his T-shirt, right? And I had a whole routine about that. And before I got into it, I mentioned that the fact that I care about this is not because I've had kids, because I've actually done stuff about this before. And I mentioned a joke from the previous show about how I saw a little girl about 12 wearing a tracksuit with the word gorgeous written across the arse of it. And I said that was inappropriate because she was a fucking minger. Right?
Sure.
But this is the thing. I would do that and it would get a big laugh. And I'm like, I did that whole routine in my last tour.
Mm.
Yet I've just done the joke, the kernel of the joke here again, and it's gotten a big laugh. And I started going, could I just do all the best stuff from the last tour and still get away with it right now?
Sure.
It's a very weird thing because not everybody could. You flatter yourself, I think, to think that everybody's coming to see you every tour. Like every time you go on the road, we've got to go and see him. Actually,
most people Birmingham
like,
have already seen this.
Yeah.
There's actually only 2,000 people.
I think a lot of people are like, well, we saw him on his last tour, so we aren't going to bother seeing him on this tour. We'll go and see Sarah Millican or Mickey Flanagan instead. So I don't really know what with that. Because then there'll be other people, if you even get a whiff of the same subject as you did on a previous show, they're like, you're doing the same material again. It's fucking lazy. It's lazy. So it's very difficult to know.
Okay.
It's one of the weird, and you know, and the fact that you've done something on TV, you'll know yourself, most of the time when you do something on TV, you're doing a shortened, watered down version of the bit.
Sure.
And then you want to do the full director's cut, as
yes,
it were,
okay.
live.
Okay. So is there anything, you're talking about creating material about stuff that happens in your life. Is there anything that's off limits? Are there any principles you don't, you know, that you have about stuff you won't talk about?
Not really, no. There was only ever one that my wife ever got really arsy with me about, but it was such a... There's a constant trade-off with me and my wife about what I will share and what I won't, and it depends on how personal it is versus how big a laugh it's getting.
Yeah, okay.
Or how fake it is, or how it makes it look versus how big a laugh it gets. I had a thing about, again, when I was talking about getting married, about how... It was to do with wedding planners, and saying all the little details are really going to matter because it's the happiest day of your life. And I'm saying, well, on the happiest day of your life, surely that's the one day where little details don't matter.
Yeah,
you know?
Okay.
And I'm going, it's the happiest day of my life. And I go, I found her. I found the woman I love more than I ever thought it possible to love another human being. And I am standing up in front of the people she likes the best and the people she likes the best of the people I know. And she never liked that one. She never liked that, but it always got a massive reaction. And sure. There was one bloke who wasn't allowed to come to the wedding because she didn't like him. But that was, you know, that was, not even because she didn't like him, because she didn't like his girlfriend. But anyway, that you know, that was one of those sort of... She wasn't quite like that, but it got such a big laugh and was so relatable. I'm sorry, love. I'm sticking with that joke. You know?
Okay.
But
okay.
There's been other things of... But very rarely would there be... Because I'm not overly, you know, offensive or anything like that anyway. So there isn't like a... I'm not always constantly, think, you know... I don't go that dark anyway that often. So,
sure,
you know.
Sure. And are there certain strategies that you use to try and unpack the funny from a subject? Because I was thinking, when you were talking about your hernia in your show, you've got a joke about the anaesthetist asking you a question as they inject anaesthetic into you.
Yeah.
And the joke, I think, is that you go, that's, you know, how, you, well, could you make it any clearer?
Yeah. Is there, because she said... She asked, because the nurse recognized me and the anaesthetist didn't. And she said, oh, so as she's giving me the injection, she goes, well, oh, what's the name of the TV show you're on? And it just, the drug just hit me. And I just went, I literally went, I don't think I can answer that question. Boom. And I was out. Which, as I point out, is silly because that's harder to say than mock the week. But the last thing I thought as I was passing out was, nothing says, I don't care what the name of the TV show you're on is, like asking, what's the name of the TV show you're on? As you're administering an anaesthetic. Like, is there a clearer indication you couldn't give a fuck about the answer to your own question?
Like, I just...
Than putting somebody to sleep as you're asking it. What's the name of the TV show you're on? Couldn't give a shit. Couldn't give a shit.
And is that genuinely what you actually thought at the time? Because I thought, how did he get the concept of anaesthetic? It's such a good observation.
It is what I thought. I didn't actually think it as I was going to say. I didn't have time to think anything. But I did think it afterwards. I did think it was funny that she asked that question. Because she really asked it like she wanted to know.
Sure.
She went, oh, what's the name of TV? She's like, it was almost like she forgot that she was putting me to sleep when she asked the question.
So is there any part of your process where you sit and write, like in a laptop or with a pad and pen? Is it all worked out?
No. It's all stuff that happens to me and I dwell on it in my head, and then I'll go to a club like Old Rope where... I don't know if you've talked about this.
It's come up before, but we could explain it for the people.
It's a great little club in London on a Monday night where they have a noose actually hanging from the ceiling, and it's just, the point is that you have to be telling the joke for the first time, and if you're not, if you're doing something you've done before, you have to just indicate it by touching the rope, and if you don't, anyone in the audience is allowed to yell Old Rope at you. And I've never actually seen it happen.
No, I don't think I've seen that happen either.
But that is the ethos of it. So
but the visual metaphor then really helps.
Yeah. And people come along knowing that you really are trying out stuff for the first time. And that's a great place to try out new stuff. It's a bit of a false friend, though, because...
Yeah, absolutely. You'll
get a big laugh or something there and then try it out at a comedy club and they'll just stare at you. The worst line I ever got from one of the worst heckles I remember early on writing my last show... I had a story that, in fairness, I didn't quite have an ending to. And it was about, I met a guy once. I was standing next to a guy in a checking queue for an airport, and I recognized him from one of the Star Trek movies. Mm-hmm. And he was a guy, Paul Winfield is the actor's name. He's a big, tall, black guy, and he played a character called Commander, Captain Terrell, he played, and in Wrath of Khan. Getting very nerdy now. But the point is, I turned to him and I said, weren't you in Wrath of Khan? And he responded by going, yes, I died so the white man could live. It's just like a real, very in the mind that the white man in question was Captain fucking Kirk, right? And it's like, and I wanted to say to him, you died, you mean Captain Kirk? You really think it's because you're a black guy and he's a white guy, not because he's captain of the fucking Enterprise and you've never even been in the TV show?
Yeah. You know?
But at the time, I didn't really have an ending for it. But it was kind of a funny story, and it kind of fizzled. And the guy, he was a Scottish bloke. He was in London, but it was a Scottish guy. He just went, is that going to be in your shoe? Yeah, you're right. It's not there yet, is it? It's not quite there yet.
Okay, so it can give you false positives.
I need to work it out on stage,
yes.
The jokes. And you'll know this as well. It's an interesting thing with stand-up comedy is that even really, really experienced comedians, I'll run a joke by a friend of mine who's a comic, and we'll agree it's hilarious, mm-hmm. and I can't wait to try it. And then I'll try it, and it just doesn't work. And he'll be like, oh, I don't understand why that doesn't work. And you're kind of like, why do we make a living? How do we make a living when we clearly don't even know what's funny or not?
Sure.
Because you'll write a joke that you think's brilliant, or maybe you'll do it on stage, and then the setup gets a big laugh, and the punchline doesn't. And you don't think the setup's particularly funny, but the punchline is. Like, there's no way of predicting it. And but we're like bankers. We actually don't know what the fuck we're doing. You know, a lot of the time, we have a vague idea, and we'll take your money, but we don't actually know what's going on. So that just came to me now, and I may use that in the future. You see, that's a perfect example of writing something on stage. Yeah, I had a joke that I thought was great about it was to do with the Sugar Babes and the fact that all three members of the Sugar Babes now are not any of the original members.
Sure.
And it was I felt it was a philosophical conundrum. Is it still the Sugar Babes? I mean, it goes back to that thing of
the Philosopher's Axe.
The Philosopher's Axe. It was somebody's ark, not Noah's. Yeah. It was somebody. And it was, if you replace all the wood,
yeah,
and eventually you replace every single piece of wood, is it still the same boat? And I felt you could apply this to the Sugar Babes, right? And then I went, and I thought this was great. I thought, like, if you've got a sweeping brush and the head rots off, so you replace it, and then the handle rots off, and so you replace that, you'd probably be thinking to yourself, I should have saved my money while I was still a member of the Sugar Babes.
Okay.
Which it's not a big laugh. Now, I think that's a very funny joke. And every time I've discussed it with comedians, I go, oh, it's brilliant. Because it's just like you think it's going one way and then it's not. It's like slightly unexpected, but it's waiting. There's a lot in that joke that I think recommends it. Does not fucking work.
Okay.
And me, and like I was on tour, I did a warm-up tour for my last tour where I was with Matthew Hardy, Australian comedian, and Nick Doody, an English comedian, both really funny comedians. And they, you know, we were looking at my stuff afterwards every night and trying to tinker with it and all that, and each other's stuff, as comedians do. But the three of us, with like 50 years in comedy between us, could not get under the hood of that joke and make it
sure.
work. So it just got pinned.
Okay. And do you mentioned this of working with other writers. Is that something that you've always done?
No, I've never worked with writers. I'm just saying in the same way that comedians, we will offer each other advice.
Give each other tags and advice and stuff like that. Sure.
Would that work better if you did this with it and stuff like that? I've never actually hired writers or anything. Not for my stand-up. I had to write a thing. Like, you might get commissioned to do I did a thing about recycling. I got asked to do a thing trying to make recycling funny. It was a campaign to get people to recycle. And so myself and Nick wrote a thing together for me to deliver.
Okay, but
I've never sat down with a writer for my stand-up.
Is that a point of principle, or is that just that you...
And then even people who've offered me lines, who've like come up to me, like Adam Bloom, for instance, who'd come up to me after a gig and go, wouldn't that be funny if you said this?
Mm-hmm.
Like, those people get a thank you on my DVD for like a line.
Sure.
You know, or like my neighbor, because he'll tell me a story and I'll go, oh, there's something in that I could use. Like, he'll get a thank you on the...
Okay.
I think there's been a lot of talk lately about the whole using writers thing.
Yeah, Bruce Desso wrote quite an interesting blog about... Oh, no, it was Stuart Lee started, didn't he? He said it's like using... It's like people...
Using steroids. Yeah.
And what's your feeling about that? Where do you fall on that?
Well, I think... If you look at something like WWE, they're all using steroids.
Sure.
You know, who cares? I think he has a point. I think with all of these things, it's always mean to call out particular acts on it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think if you reach a certain level of fame, or if you're doing a TV show and you recruit writers for that, because you're suddenly there's a demand on you to come up with 6 half-hour.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're from the word go, I would complain about the fact that you've had it on, but it's an R2-D2 tech, that's why you're a hero.
do feel free to turn that off, though.
Yeah, I think if you're someone who from the word go has hired writers,
yes,
you know, then I think...
Do you think people do that? Are there people who...
Apparently so, and I don't want to name names, even because I've just said it's not right to call people out specifically.
Sure.
But...
But is that? Do you think that's
like
a consequence?
I think people assume nowadays, and that all comedians are like, you know, singer songwriters. That everybody's creating their own stuff,
mm-hmm.
and that they're not like boy bands.
Sure,
and
sure.
I think that there are some that are.
At least with musicians, the public can tell the difference between a singer-songwriter and a boy band. And you'd feel rightly cheated if you found out that a singer-songwriter, like Damien Rice, say, what you're paying for is his thoughts poured out through his music.
Yeah,
but you can tell if it's you know, I can't think of a single boy. JLS, are they a boy band? Yeah, you can kind of go, okay, they're manufactured. But with comedy, I think people have got different takes on this idea of. It's frustrating to see a comedian and go, oh, you're manufactured, but there's no way of anyone knowing that.
Yeah, and I think there's an assumption on everybody's part that when somebody's on stage, like in the old days, and Bob Hope and people like that had writers, and even Bob Munkos, even though Bob Munkos also wrote for loads of other people, he then had writers in turn himself. And I think that was accepted then. But I think nowadays, people just, there's an assumption that you're creating all the things that you're saying. So I think it is kind of,
and is cheating. That? Do you think is there an analogy there with directors? Because I know a lot of comedians, or more comedians than I realised when I started, use directors for their shows.
Well, again, no, I don't think that's a problem at all. For the simple reason, because a lot of them will credit on their poster, and also because my little brother makes a living as a director for comedians.
Sure.
So I think more people should use them. More people should. Then eventually he can pay me back the money he owes me. Because he doesn't. I mean, he works very well, and it's a very collaborative thing the way he works with comedians, in that he doesn't write their jokes for them, but he'll just go, particularly when it comes to Edinburgh, and people are trying to construct an hour long show, he'll say, maybe it'd be better if you put that at the end or move that to there, and you know, in the middle, I think you should do something that's a bit more like this. And he just helps draw their own creativity out of themselves, and I think that's.
That's just very different to handing someone a paper.
It's different to go in here, tell people that you actually went to see Star Wars when you didn't, you know.
Sure. Okay. So in terms of when we're talking about the process of creation.
Because again, not naming names, we were talking about somebody the other night who was doing a routine about Star Wars, and the person was referred to a Wookiee as a Wookiee.
Yeah.
And you're like, you haven't even seen the fucking film.
I've
Your writer has, but you clearly haven't even seen this film.
I've heard a similar story about someone trying political stuff out and then saying, I don't even know who that is, you know, on stage. But like, we'll continue this discussion in the... Yeah.
And you were like, hang on, we thought we were getting the proper lifting the lid here, and you're still keeping secrets from us.
Comedy fan, the more time you spend learning about comedy, the more you'll start to find out the rumours about things like this.
A collective noun for comedians is a bitch of comedians.
Yeah. let's just draw it back to you. And on the subject of creation, of creating stuff, I want to talk about your persona on stage, because I feel like I can't necessarily put you into a pigeonhole as a comedian. And I think now, because you've got, because a lot of the comedy superstars are like someone like Mickey Flanagan, you can sort of go, okay, he's that, and there hasn't been one of those before. Do you know what I mean? Or John Bishop or Peter Kay. I think it's harder to pin down exactly who you are. Do you know what I mean? Like,
and that's probably why I'm not as famous as those three people you mentioned. I think, yeah.
What do you think it is? Is that part of it? Something I struggle with a lot is going, okay, who am I? Where am I coming from other than some guy that thinks the things I think?
Yeah, I don't think I make as conscious a decision as that.
Okay.
And perhaps I ought, you know.
Okay.
But basically, me on stage is just me turned up to 11.
That's okay.
I'm probably slightly more angry. I'm a lot more funny. Even my accent is just sometimes is slightly, although less now, but when I was starting out, my accent was just ever so slightly more Irish. Just everything about me was just tweaked up just a little bit more.
Sure.
And, you know, I'm slightly more nerdy or erudite or whatever. I mean, everything about me, I'm just slightly more than that on stage. It's like a distillation, as it were, of
Have you ever experimented with trying to sort of find a person to be? Find
no,
a voice?
When I started out, I wanted to be like Michael Redmond, who was like a deadpan one-liner merchant. And it just didn't happen. And I remember Ben Elton saying the very same thing, that when he started out, he wanted to be quite sort of laid back and cool on stage, but he had this nervous energy that made him just talk very quickly, and so he became this ranty thing, because that's just what came. And I was like the exact same thing. I wanted to be a kind of, I liked a lot of laid back American comedians as well, who were just kind of like, so what's in the news today, you know, and I wanted to be like that. But as soon as I got on the stage, I'm like, hey, okay, like me, okay, we all like me, yeah, I like me, well, I don't, not enough to not do this for a living, but I like myself a bit, you know, and I just had that nervous energy as well.
Okay.
And so I'm a fast talking, you know, slightly more ranty.
And how do you think, if there's no kind of contrivance on your part as to who you are, And it doesn't sound like there is. And I don't mean contrivance in a negative way, do you know what I mean? But like someone like Milton Jones, for example, finds a certain way to deliver his stuff. If you have just been yourself turned up to 11, how do you think audiences react to that? Do you think you're seen as like an everyman? Or how do you think audiences see you?
Yeah, I'd like to think that people will come away feeling like they know you that little bit better. You know, in fact, it's a great thing, because I come to the festival pretty much every 2 years and my friends will come along, and there's people who I only get to see at this festival every couple of years, and we'll go out for a drink afterwards and they don't need to ask me anything.
That is convenient.
So what have you been up to the last? Because I already know. So you had a second kid, and you've had a hernia, and you went on a driver awareness guy. You know, the things that have happened in my life, they already know, so I can just ask them. And it's that thing about being relatable. One of the nicest compliments I think I've had wasn't even from me. It was in the last show, or the one before, I think it was. And because I had mentioned my wife a number of times and funny things that she had done, this woman just sat like sort of second row. I just heard her go, "I love his wife." it's really nice that she came across the way she did in the stories that I tell about her. You know?
Yeah, and people feel like they know you and they know your family.
And it's weird because with a couple of other comedy, we climbed Ben Nevis on Monday, and then we were sitting in a bar afterwards, just having a swift half before coming home, and the guy next he'd been to the show, and he's like, Sahara, Cosmo and Magnus, who are my kids, you know. And it's like, at first, this is a bit, but you forget that you are sharing this information with people.
Sure.
You
know? Are there any drawbacks? Are there any downsides to being so sort of nakedly open with your life?
I don't know. I'm sure identity theft will probably become an issue at some point.
But does it ever cross your mind that people will know your children as your children grow up? There might be stuff on YouTube about you talking about them.
Yeah, but not in a horrible way. And there'll come a point, because I know John Bishop has come up against this now. His kids have reached an age now where it's not fair for him to do stuff about them anymore, because they're at school and people know who his dad is and stuff like that. Okay. He was doing stuff about them before where they were kind of anonymous figures and obviously that'll happen. But I mean, Bill Cosby is a classic example. He's a master of the art, and he really still has got it at this stage. And he has this lovely thing where he talks about his family like we all know them. He's talking about his wife, Camille, and, you know. And it's just really, I like that. I aspire to be like that, you know.
You mentioned a moment ago, when I mentioned those sort of people like Mickey Flanagan and that, and you said, oh, you know, that's why they're more successful than I am. And you also had a line, I think, in your Different Class show, where you were talking about the spare DVDs you had left over.
Yeah.
There was some reference to the fact that you were exploring the idea that you were sort of successful and famous,
not
but
quite.
Somewhere
I had this in-betweeny thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So how do you feel about your level of success?
I think I'm exactly where I deserve to be. I think I am. You know what? I've had 4-star reviews across the board for this show, and I think that's fair. I think I'm not going, oh, this is a 5-star show. These people are idiots. I'm going, yeah, 4, no, that's fair. And if I had a 3-star review, I'd be like, oh, that's a bit harsh. You know?
Okay.
I'm a 4-star comedian. And I make a handsome living out of being a 4-star comedian. I think that's the.
It's
not like I don't aspire to greatness. You know, I'm aware of my own limitations.
Have you always been? Were you kind of burning passionately for 5-star reviews, and you didn't get them, and so you sort of accommodated that?
No, I mean in '98 when I got nominated for the Perrier, and I got 5-star reviews from most of the publications. You know, and that was great. You know. And I you shouldn't care about these things, but I'm shallow and I do. Mm-hmm. So the thing is, all right, an individual reviewer's opinion, you can say, doesn't matter. But when when there's a consensus, I think it's fair enough to take that on board, you know. And I was here in 2004 and I got a hammering, and I went, oh, you know, and I hadn't been doing it for a while, and I'd gotten lazy, and I was living high on the Carphone Warehouse money, and you know. And I'd taken my foot off the gas. And so I came back up in 2006, renewed and revigored, and, you know, and since then, the shows have gotten consistently much better than they were then. And I think you do have to a certain extent, listen to your critics, because, you know, they watch a lot of comedy, most of them. And it's very easy to go, fucking critics, what do they know? Well, some of them at least know something. And if they all say the same thing, then I think, you've got to take that on board. So saying it's 4 stars. And they're right.
Do you read the reviews when you're up here during the process?
I do, yeah.
Okay.
And a lot of comedians do and say that they don't, and some genuinely don't. But yeah, I do.
And do you engage with that? Do you sort of take it on board? Would you ever change something? Because say three reviews came out that hammered one particular point. Would you think I should change that or would you ignore it?
Yeah, I probably would. But then you also get feedback through, you know, other sources like Twitter and things like that as well, you know. Or my wife, who is a publicist and so has her ear to the ground with, you know, journalists and stuff like that. And I think any kind of... and talking to people who've been to the show, you know, any kind of feedback, I'm happy to go. Yeah, maybe that's not. But the best feedback is when you're actually on stage and you're going, that's not working, so you cut it out.
Sure.
I had a bit that I was really enjoying doing. It's just not flying because it's just too long and too wordy, and people are going to go, yeah, that's a good point, and that's all it gets. So I just dropped it.
Okay.
Which was about the fact that. About how intense and angry people get over what I think to be meaningless things, whether it's the football team they support or their flag or their cross or, you know, the picture of their prophet or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. That there's a process in training a dog called loading the clicker, where every time you click the clicker, you give the dog a treat. And the dog, it so intrinsically links the treat to the clicker that the clicker now is all it's required. You don't have to give the dog a treat anymore because dogs are smart. Well, they're not that fucking smart, right? But we do it to ourselves. We do it to ourselves, but we imbue meaningless things with importance. We decide we're going to follow that football team, and that's just and that's all we're going to care about. Or we decide we're going to follow that religion, or we decide that flag is our national flag. And whenever somebody gets really, really irate because you burnt their flag or you drew a picture of their prophet or you slagged off their football team, whenever somebody gets really, really annoyed by these things, I always think, you'd make a really good pet. And it's one of those, yeah, it's a good point. I like what you've done there. It's not that funny, though. So, you know,
okay.
So you've got quite
high quality control. As a, you know, you're happy to...
Yeah, and you trade things off and that you'll go, it'll be something that's just completely meaningless and just is funny, and that's great. And you try and... You like to have things that where you're making a point. Like I say, my thing about the Workshire, I'm very happy with it. I think it's a very funny bit and it's a very funny concept where I basically... My point, but I'm not going to do the whole thing, but my point is that they're trying to cap benefits to get the Workshire... you know, into the workplace. And I said, that's a terrible idea because that's where they can do the most damage, you know. And
sure.
My whole thing is to get the work shy out of the workplace and onto the fucking dole where they won't be in my way anymore. You know, that's kind of the point of it.
Sure.
And it's a really, I love it because it's a really weird, angry rant against work shy people. That's really very left wing because it's like we should make the dole more attractive, but it's really very right wing and that I completely fucking hate people who are lazy. So
sure. It's
a really interesting bit. People are cheering and it's almost like, I'm not quite sure what I'm cheering for.
Yeah.
You know, but I will follow this man.
Sure, okay.
You know, I'm really enjoying. You know?
Okay, we've just got a few minutes left. I want to give the audience a chance to ask questions. If anyone would like to ask a question, normally there's a bit of a pause here while people look at me blankly, as many of you are doing. So I'll ask another question while you have a chance to think some up.
Look at that. See, that's a classic. That's learning from experience. That is.
Yeah, you're too right. So I wanted to ask, I'm sure you've been asked before your advice for new comedians. That comes up a lot. I'd like to ask you your advice for comedians who are sort of mid-level, who've been going for a while, say 5, 6, 7 years in. What's your advice for people in that situation?
The kind of advice I would offer would not be something people would want to hear, which would be wait before you just do anything that the TV throws at you.
That's exactly the advice they want to hear. That's great advice.
But it's the complete opposite of what I did, you know.
Okay.
I mean, I just, when I was new, I just did anything, you know. And in a way, it helps, certainly in the short to medium term, to just do whatever comes your way. Because you just, if you're playing the club circuit and you get on stage and you've been on Call My Bluff or whatever, people don't remember what it is they've seen you on. But people just kind of go, yeah, okay, he's familiar.
And that
just gives you a little bit extra...
That
they just assume, oh, he's probably quite funny because I think I've seen him on TV, but I can't remember what on.
Okay.
You know, so that sort of getting your face out there. At the time, that was what I felt.
Gotcha.
My
okay.
point.
Yes.
But I would say now, looking back, don't just do anything that is offered to you.
Okay. I had heard, and I heard this credited to Phil Jupitus, but I've not spoken to him. I don't know if he said it. But I'd heard that an act, call him Phil, had said, if you want to be on TV, you need to start being on TV. You need to be one of the people that's on TV so that you get considered for other TV stuff.
Yes, and that's certainly, and that is a weird, it's a constant trade-off. And I still am today. I'm doing things that I'm not entirely comfortable with. because I'm on tour and I need to sell tickets, or okay. because I want to do another TV show and I need to be known, and I'm trying to keep the channel sweet and stuff like that. Okay. And it's a horrible, grubby aspect of the industry
sure.
that you kind of have to just play the game of. I mean, yeah, fine, if you're Ricky Gervais and you write an award-winning sitcom, you don't have to do that shit. Mm-hmm. But if you're me... If you're a four-star comedian, you need to play this game if you want to, you know, eventually segue into having a show about climbing mountains.
Sure,
you
sure.
know, whatever it is.
Okay, great. Thank you. We can just take a couple of questions before we wind up over here. If you just, I'll need to repeat it for the sake of the recording, but ask away. So when you first, sorry, I'm not quite sure what you mean. Do you mean like picking subjects in advance and trying to write about them?
Did I find myself gravitated towards particular subjects, yeah. and how did I eventually break free of the subjects I was originally yeah. gravitated towards? I did. At first, it was very ladsy, my material, you know, and I'm performing in late night, you know, drinky venues, and you know, coming to the fringe, you know, I was here in '94, you know, doing So You Think You're Funny, and then doing a few gigs at like the Fringe Club and stuff like that, and real sort of bear pit gigs, and you're doing stuff that's going to please that crowd, and I was doing stuff about smoking and drinking and shagging and fighting, and that was, you know, and pretty much being bad at all of them. And yeah, so I gravitated towards, I would say, probably just fairly, not, I guess, easy subjects that people just things that are in everyday people's lives that people could relate to. But I think there's no desire to get away from those subjects. I think, again, the key to good comedy is because there's that thing of, oh, that subject is hack. But you can be the person who has the best routine on that subject. You know, I'm flattering myself now, but it was somebody else said that I've been told I have the best routine on airlines losing your luggage, you know. And it's a hack route. It's a hack subject, airlines losing your luggage, or airlines. But again, Louis C.K. has a beautiful routine about disembarking aircraft.
Yeah.
In a way that other comedians go, I'm not touching that subject because it's just been done. But if you're really... know what you're doing, you can still find something new in a subject people have tackled before. So there's no subjects that I would shy away from because they're unoriginal subjects. I think if you put a personal spin on them, mm-hmm. on getting married and having kids, stuff that people have been talking about for a long time, then you'll still find something new.
We've probably just got time for about one more. So do you have a pre-show, or we know that you do, have pre-show rituals, but...
This man watches me, he knows.
Do they change depending on the size or the type of the gig?
No, they don't change depending on the size of the gig, certainly, but I, like, for instance, the first couple of shows here in Edinburgh, I was more nervous and more trying to concentrate on remembering all the stuff, so I'm just a bit more contemplative, I guess you could say, but other than that, there isn't massive... I did for a while... For a while there, I would play a game, whether I had like an Xbox with me or an iPad or something like that. I stopped doing that because it just I found I got too frustrated beforehand. Like, I'm you're supposed to play games to relax, but I just play games and a lot of the time they just fucking annoy me. Like, you're playing Angry Birds, you're like, I can't figure this out. You're due on stage 5 minutes ago. Fuck! You know, so I've stopped doing that. But no, I don't. I generally have a beer before I go on and have another and bring it on with me. I don't like to go on stage with anything in my pockets.
Yeah.
It's just one of those little things. But that's really about it. I don't turn around three times or anything like that, and I don't have vocal warm-up exercises or anything. What I do like to do is I always have, particularly when I'm on tour or doing a one-man show, is I have pre-show music. It's one of my favourite things getting ready for a festival is putting together a playlist of 20 minutes to half an hour to play to the audience as they're coming in. And I love that. And I always like to... that's to get me in the mood and them in the mood. And that's one of my favourite things. So I'm generally dancing behind the stage before I go on. And air guitar.
That seems like a lovely place to end it. And unfortunately, that's what time means that we have to do. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Mr. Ed Byrne. So that was Ed. Thanks to him for coming along and applying himself to that so readily. I really think we got loads out of Ed there. Crowd Pleaser by Ed Byrne, a previous show of his, is available on audible.co.uk. And if you go to audible.co.uk/cc for Comedians Comedian and sign up there, you can get a copy for free. You get a free gift when you sign up for a trial.
Plus, you can support this podcast at the same time. If you go via /CC, then they give us a little kickback. So do that. That would be my advice. My partial advice, I should say, in that it is not impartial. Thanks to everyone. Thanks to Ed for coming on the show. Thanks to Pete Jones and James Lowry for their technical assistance. Thanks to Sarah Grun for her help with today's Podmin. And this episode was co-produced by Nathan Wood. Who is this Nathan Wood guy I keep mentioning? He's a really good dude that's helping me edit the shows together, saving me loads of valuable time by doing things like converting tracks and making it all sound better than it was before, than I could possibly make it sound. And thanks to your donations, I have been able to pay him a tiny bit of cash. Huzzah. So do keep them coming if you can at comedianscomedian.com. Tweet me at ComComPod. Tell your friends. Spread the word. All over their faces, and then lick it off. Sorry, it's all this Benelin. I'm going peculiar. Speak to you soon. Bye for now.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.